So we now begin our introduction to Pali class, and I welcome you all to this class, who will be using as our basic textbook a book called A New Course in Reading Pali, Entering the Word of the Buddha. This textbook is compiled by James W. Gare and W. S. Karunatilaka. I find that this book is quite useful in taking us directly into short passages from the Pali Suttas, and we will be studying the grammar and vocabulary of Pali by working directly with these short texts from the Pali Suttas themselves. I hope that you who are studying Pali in this way will be able to grasp the fundamentals of the grammar through this very direct, hands-on approach. But if you are finding it difficult to proceed in this very direct way to the study of the Pali language, then I would recommend as a preliminary procedure that you go online and find online a Pali Primer by Lily De Silva. The name of the work is A Pali Primer, and the author is Lily De Silva, D-E-S-I-L-V-A. This book is made available over the website of the Vipassana Research Society. But you just have to enter in Google's the search for Lily De Silva Pali Primer, and Google will take you right to that web page. What I suggest is that you then work through the exercises in Lily De Silva's book. You do the exercises of translating from Pali into English. I don't think you need bother translating from English into Pali unless you intend to become a professional translator of works from English into Pali. And it's very unlikely that you intend to develop that skill. But learning the fundamentals of the grammar and doing the very simple exercises from Pali into English will help you build up a knowledge of the building blocks of Pali grammar. And once you build up that knowledge of the building blocks of Pali grammar, then you can come back to the new course in reading Pali. But those of you who are more adventurous can proceed directly into a new course in reading Pali, and I'll be going through each of the reading exercises, giving fuller explanations of the grammar, and dealing with each of the knotty grammatical points raised by each of the lessons. Okay, I'd like to start first by dealing in this introductory lesson with some more general aspects of the Pali language. And first, I want to explain the name of the Pali language itself. Of course, it's quite interesting to know that the name of the Pali language arose through something of a misunderstanding. We don't actually know the original name of the language, or even whether there was a specific name for this language. But the word Pali within this language means a row or a line. And the word came to be assigned to Buddhist texts because the texts were written in lines of words. Originally, the texts were inscribed on ola leaves. These are leaves of a kind of palm tree. And the scribes who would write them would write the characters in lines very elegantly. And so the texts were called Pali. Then at a certain point, the distinction came to be made between canonical texts, texts that were regarded as the authorized Buddha Vachana, word of the Buddha, and the commentaries on these texts. The commentaries were written by generations of Buddhist monks, beginning from a very early period, who would attempt to explain the meanings of the words, phrases, and the doctrines contained in them. At this point, a distinction was made, and the canonical texts were called Pali, and the commentaries were called Attakatta. Attakatta. So, the Pali are the canonical texts, the commentaries are the Attakatta, which means discussion of the meaning, explanation of the meaning. In the very early period of Buddhist history in Sri Lanka, the canonical texts were preserved in the ancient Indian language in which they were originally transmitted to Sri Lanka, to the island of Sri Lanka. But the commentaries in this early phase were written and preserved in the language of Sri Lanka. At that time, this was the ancestor of the present-day Sinhala language. That language was called Hela, an early form of Sinhala. And so the commentators would refer to the language of the canonical texts as Pali Bhasa. I write that down. It's P long A L I B H long A S long A. Pali Bhasa, which means the language of the canonical texts. It also is called Tanti Bhasa. Tanti means the transmission, the transmitted heritage of the canonical texts. So Tanti Bhasa was the language of the transmitted texts. But the more frequent expression was Pali Bhasa, the language of the canonical texts. And at a certain point, I'm not sure whether this understanding developed amongst Asian scholars, Asian commentators, or European, early European scholars, but the phrase Pali Bhasa was misunderstood to mean not the language of the canonical texts, but the Pali language, a language called Pali. And so in this way, the language in which the canonical text was preserved was understood to be a language known as Pali, a language called Pali. And in this way, Pali came to be known, the word Pali came to be used to designate that language. Of course, in the 5th century, the old commentaries which had been preserved in this early Sinhala language, Hela, were edited and translated into the language of the canonical texts, into Pali, and from then on they were preserved in the Pali language. And so the distinction between the language of the texts and the language of the commentaries disappeared. And so all of the commentaries and sub-commentaries have subsequently been written in the language we call Pali. So there are distinct stylistic differences between the language of the canonical texts and the language of the commentaries. The language of the canonical texts has a much more distinctly oral flavor to it. It's clearly a spoken language. We could see it in the nuances of conversation, the dialectical tone of the language, whereas the language of the commentaries is a literary language. And by the time we get to the tikkas or sub-commentaries, it becomes an extremely sophisticated, extremely refined literary language, using many of the conventions of Sanskrit philosophical literature. Many of the conventions and many of the technical terms of Sanskrit philosophical literature. In terms of its place in the world family of languages, it might be something of a surprise for you to know that Pali belongs to the same broad family of languages that English belongs to. That is, both English and Pali are very distant cousins within this broad family of languages, which is called the Indo-European languages. They both originated from tribes inhabiting the central Indo-Europe, central Asian plains. These tribes moved out in different directions. One group of tribes spread out westward, going on to inhabit Europe, moving from across Europe, settling in Greece, Italy, moving across to Germany, moving across and then even crossing the English Channel and settling in Britain. Another branch of this group of tribes moved eastwards. One branch of it settled in Persia. And from that group, from that tribe, the Persian language, Old Persian language, evolved. And then still another branch of that community, ancient community, moved even further eastwards, crossed over the, which group of mountains, spread over Pakistan, what's now Pakistan, spread through Afghanistan, Pakistan, crossed over the mountains, and then entered into what is now India and settled in northern India. And as their language evolved, it turned into a language which is known as Vedic Sanskrit. These became the settlers, the Brahminic or the Aryan settlers of northern India, and their language in turn, in time, became Vedic Sanskrit. And so all of the languages which derive from that original language are called the Indo-Aryan languages, and the original ancestor of that whole family of languages is Vedic Sanskrit. Vedic Sanskrit is called the old or archaic Indo-Aryan language. Pali belongs to a group of languages called the Middle Indo-Aryan languages, sometimes abbreviated as MIA, Middle Indo-Aryan. Okay, as Vedic Sanskrit became an archaic, purely literary language, the common people throughout northern India came to use a variety of dialects based on Vedic Sanskrit, derived from Vedic Sanskrit, but modified to take on simpler grammatical forms, using different idioms, simplified in its grammar. And so these were the Prakrits, the more natural languages, the simplified languages. Among these Prakrits were Magadhi, the language that was used in the state of Magadha in the time of the Buddha. There would have been Kosalan, the language used in the state of Kosala. There would have been Paisachi, the language used in the western part of India. Okay, so we have a variety of dialects that were used in the different parts of India during the centuries, we could say from perhaps 6th century BC, 5th century BC, 4th century BC. These were called the Middle Indo-Aryan languages. Magadhi, the language of the state of Magadha. Ardha Magadhi, this is half Magadhi, a sort of modified form of Magadhi. Kosalan, the language of the state of Kosala. Perhaps there would have been a language we call Bengali, the language used in the region around the Vanga Basin, where the Ganges empties out into the Bay of Bengal. That would have been a precursor of the modern Bengali language. And in Sri Lanka, the language called Hela also belonged to the same family of Middle Indo-Aryan languages. And these are languages are also called Prakrits, which means natural languages, as opposed to Sanskrit, which means a refined language. Okay, now Pali, according to contemporary philologists, was not actually a spoken language. It was not a language that was actually used, but it was a synthetic language, a language that was created by combining features of several of the Middle Indo-Aryan languages to create a kind of universal language, a language that would be comprehensible to Buddhist monks living in a wide range of monasteries scattered throughout northern India. This is a hypothesis, it's not a known fact, but a hypothesis according to some modern philologists. Theravadan Buddhists themselves believe that Pali was the language spoken by the Buddha, and they identify Pali with Magadhi, the language of the state of Magadha. We do not have any actual concrete examples of Magadhi used during the Buddha's own time, but we do have edicts put up by King Ashoka, perhaps 150 or 200 years after the Buddha, and those are said to be inscribed in the Magadhi that was used during King Ashoka's time. And from that language, we could see that, from these inscriptions, we could see that this language differed in some respects from the language of the Pali Buddhist texts. It's not that the languages are very radically different, but there are certain differences in sound values and structure that indicate that the two languages are not identical. They're very similar, but not identical. The prevailing hypothesis is that the earliest Buddhist texts would have been preserved, could have been preserved, in a language that was used in the eastern part of India where the Buddha lived and taught, perhaps in the old Magadhi itself. But then as the Buddhist texts were transmitted to different parts of India. They came to be transformed into the language of the different regions. We can't actually say translated, because these were all different dialectical variations on pretty much the same language. And so it was more a matter of transposing the language from one dialect into another, rather than translating it into a completely different language, the way we might translate a novel written in English into French or into Japanese. And so the text came to be preserved and transmitted in a variety of dialects, and then to create a homogeneous language, one that would be intelligible to monks living in different regions, this language called Pali was created. And the features of Pali are said to be predominantly those of the western region of India. And so it's the hypothesis is put forth that Pali was probably used basically by monks living in the western region of India, but it included some eastern features to make it intelligible to monks living in the eastern parts of India. I'll read a passage from a book by Oscar van Hinuber, who is formerly the editor of the Critical Pali Dictionary. He's a leading philological Pali scholar in Germany. And this book is called A Handbook of Pali Literature. He says, Pali has never been a spoken language, neither in Magadha nor elsewhere. For it is possible to infer from linguistic peculiarities of this language that it has been created as some kind of lingua franca, that is, a universal language, presumably used in a large area at a time considerably later than the time of the Buddha. The evidence on which these conclusions are based are the inscriptions of King Ashoka of the 3rd century BC, which allow us to draw a very rough linguistic map of northern India. This map shows that Pali is rooted in a language spoken in western India, far away from the homeland of Buddhism. At the same time, certain eastern features embedded in Pali point to the fact that the texts have been recast from an earlier eastern version into their present western linguistic shape. Therefore, it is evident that the text is found in the Theravada Buddhist canon, though the oldest Buddhist texts surviving are the result of a lengthy and complicated development. Okay, sometime after the Pali texts were collected, and the Pali Sutta Pitaka and probably the early form of the Vinaya Pitaka took shape, the rules of classical Sanskrit were formulated, and Sanskrit became the predominant language of the intellectual class in India, the literary and philosophical language. And so all the intelligentsia were expected to know Sanskrit and to use Sanskrit for higher levels of communication. It was the language of the courtly elite, the language of the Brahmins, the language of philosophers, poets, dramatists. And all of this had an impact on Buddhist literature as well. Buddhist poets would compose their poems in classical Sanskrit. Buddhist philosophers would write their treatises in classical Sanskrit. The Buddhist Mahayana Sutras were written in a form of Sanskrit, partly influenced by the earlier, older Prakrit language. And the Pali texts were also subjected to a partial process of Sanskritization, so that the Pali text that we have access to now, today, are probably not identical with the Pali text that would have been circulating in the 3rd century BC. We can observe from these texts certain features that show that they've undergone a partial process of Sanskritization. For example, we have the word Brahmana we meet in the Pali texts. But this word Brahmana is a Sanskrit word which would not correspond to the old Middle Indo-Aryan form of the word, which could have been something like Bhamana. We have forms of a grammatical form called the gerund or absolutive, which in Pali we have words like katva, having done, disva, having seen, gantva, having gone, huntva, having slain, having killed. This tva ending to indicate the absolutive demonstrates a process of Sanskritization. Okay, let's just take a brief overview of the literature that's been preserved in Pali. The most important body of literature that's been preserved in Pali is, of course, the Pali Canon, the collection of authorized Buddha scriptures, the scriptures of Theravada Buddhism, which we also call the Pali Tipitaka, the three compilations or three collections, the Sutta Pitaka, the collection of the Buddha's discourses and discourses of disciples, which also includes some later exegetical works, analytical works, like the Patisamvita Magga and the two Nidesas, as well as poetical compilations like the Dhammapada, Sutta Nipata, and the verses of the elder monks and nuns, the Theragata and Therigata. Then we have the Vinaya Pitaka, the collection of the discipline, monastic discipline, which lays down the rules governing the lives of the monks, the bhikkhus, and the nuns, the bhikkhunis, and the general regulations governing the life of the Sangha, rules, regulations governing ordination, governing the Patimokkha recitation, governing the Vasa, the rains retreat, governing robes, governing food, governing medicines, concerned with lodgings. The third compilation in the Tipitaka is called the Abhidhamma Pitaka. This is a collection of 7 philosophical treatises, which evidently comes from a somewhat later period than the oldest parts of the Sutta Pitaka and the Vinaya Pitaka. The Abhidhamma treatises are philosophical or psychological treatises which give a systematic treatment to the doctrinal teachings of early Buddhism, casting or recasting the teachings in the form of a philosophical psychology or a psychological philosophy. Okay, then, after the Tipitaka, and many of the books in the Tipitaka have this feature of an oral language. We have to remember that for 400 years, 300, 400 years, the Tipitaka was preserved through oral transmission, and so it has the features of an oral body of literature, a lot of repetition, simple sentence structure, minor variations on simple patterns. The next major stage of Pali literature is constituted by the Attakathas. These are the commentaries, the commentaries to the books of the canon, the books of the Tipitaka. Many of these are the works of the great commentator Acharya Buddhaghosa, or at least they're ascribed to him and considered to have been composed under his supervision, under his editorship. And the language of the Attakathas is somewhat different from that of the canonical text. Here we have a formal literary language, somewhat more elegant, certainly more complicated. Then we have the Tikas, which are the sub-commentaries. Which give more refined analysis of the text, explanations of knotty points arising out of the commentaries, and which employ quite sophisticated techniques of philosophical analysis, drawing upon techniques of philosophical explanation that were being used by the Indian philosophical writers of about the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries. Another important body of Pali literature are the Sri Lankan chronicles, the historical chronicles that record the history of Sri Lanka. We have the most important of the Dipavangsa, the early history of the island. This was followed by the Mahavangsa, the great history of the island. And this was continued in a work called the Chulavangsa, which continues the history of the island. Then we have a number of other vangsas, which give the history of the Bodhi tree, the history of the great stupa at Anuradhapura, and other chronicles recording the histories of other events and sacred objects in Sri Lanka. Another body of work composed in Pali are the manuals or handbooks. These are compressed, concise manuals on topics in the Vinaya and the Abhidhamma especially. And the most important, or at least the most widely used of these little manuals is the Abhidhammata Sangaha, what's called the Manual of Abhidhamma. A little treatise or a little manual of some 50 pages, which is considered the compressed essence of the whole Abhidhamma Pitaka. Additionally, we have poetry composed in Pali, as well as other types of literature. But our main focus, of course, in this course is going to be to learn to read suttas, the discourses of the Buddha in Pali. Now I want to look at the Pali alphabet, to go through the alphabet. And so you could turn in your book now, our textbook, Gare and Karuna Tilaka, to page 14 in Roman numerals in the introduction, and you'll see a diagram showing the Pali alphabet. And the explanation of the Pali and Sanskrit alphabet is quite interesting.
You see, in this alphabet, the vowels and the consonants are kept separate, not like in English, very sloppy alphabet, where the two are just mixed indiscriminately together. And the vowel and the consonants are grouped very systematically into distinct classes, arranged in a very precise order. You see, the main part of the consonants, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5 rows set in 5 columns, so that there are 25 consonants. The 5 columns represent 5 different classes of consonants, depending upon the particular part of the mouth, or let's say the particular part of the vocal apparatus where that consonant is formed. One begins at the lowest point, deep in the throat, with what are called the velars. I learned these as the gutturals. One begins these deep in the throat. This is the group beginning with the K. Then one moves up to the palatals, where one forms the consonant from the palate. Then one goes to the retroflex, where one forms the consonant against the roof of the mouth. Then one comes to the dental, where one forms the consonant against the teeth. And then one comes to the labial, where one forms the consonant again with the lips. And then each of these columns, you see, it's divided into 5 rows. These are divided as voiceless non-aspirate. Okay, now we have each type of consonant is first divided into a non-aspirate, that's like the K, and then an aspirate is like the KH. When we find a consonant followed by an H, we should not think that these are 2 separate letters in Pali. This is just the way we represent that letter in using the English alphabet. But in the Asian alphabets, that particular letter would be represented by only 1 letter, not by 2. And the aspirate has the same basic sound as the non-aspirate, except that there is a little puff of air that comes after it. That is why it is called an aspirate. The aspirate means a breath, a little puff of air, like respiration, breathing. Okay, so one group is the aspirate, the non-aspirate and aspirated form of what are called the voiceless consonants. I call these the hard consonants. And then the other two, the next two, are called the voiced consonants. I call them the soft consonants. That is like the G, the G, and the G. The non-aspirate and the aspirated form of G. And then the 5th member of each group is the nasal, a consonant which is in some way involved the use of the nose, the ung. According to Hindu theory, or perhaps ancient Brahminic theory, the Indian alphabet is supposed to represent the original sound of creation, when Brahma, the sound through which Brahma, the deity Brahma, created the universe. He begins with the vowels. The vowels are the easiest sounds. Yao. Yeah. Then he begins with the consonants, taking the consonants from the throat, bringing the world out into being from his throat, through his mouth, out the mouth, through the lips, and then out into space, and then the world exists. And so the world becomes the manifestation, the literal manifestation of the divine word. We could say, like, this is almost a literal representation, a literal interpretation of the beginning of the fourth gospel. In the beginning was the Word. Okay, so now I will go through the alphabet and I will recite each of the sounds, each of the letters, each of the sounds. And the question might occur to your mind, what did the Pali alphabet originally look like? Well, actually, you see, in the Buddha's time, the Pali scriptures were not written down, but for 400 years they were transmitted orally. When they were first written down, probably in Sri Lanka in about the first century, they must have been written down in the ancient Brahmi letters that were used in Sri Lanka at that time. And then in each country to which the Pali scriptures have spread, each country to which the Pali scriptures have spread has used its own alphabet to represent the Pali text, the Pali words. So in Sri Lanka, the present-day Sinhala script is used to represent them. In Burma, the Burmese script is used to represent them. In Thailand, the Thai script. In Cambodia, the Cambodian script. In India, currently the Devanagari script is used to represent them. And we represent them using Roman letters like this. To represent them in Roman letters, we have to use certain special devices, particularly diacritical marks, to indicate specific sounds. Diacritical marks and the doubling of letters. That is, by joining an H, two consonants, to represent the aspirated consonants. Okay, so let us begin with the vowels. Start with for the A, short A, I'll speak a word, samana, which means ascetic or monk. It's a very short A, almost like the U in but, samana. The long A. Ah. Ah. This will be the first A in the word Brahmana. The long A in the word for water. Apo. Apo. Okay, the I, E, E. If the I is followed by a double consonant, it comes out almost like the I in pin. Take the word for woman. Here we'll have the I occurs twice, first followed by a double T, so it comes like the I in pin, then it comes at the end where it will be like a full I, E. So, iti, iti. Here is an I coming at the end of a word. I'm going to give the verb for to imagine. Manyati, manyati. The long I is simply that I sound extended. The name of a monk, Sivali, that first I, Sivali. The word means destroyed. The first I here, Kina, Kina. Okay, the U, U, the word for a monk, Bhikkhu, that U that comes here, Bhikkhu, word for cause, the U at the end, Hetu. Okay, the extended U is just that U join out, U. The word for a being, Buddha, Buddha. Okay, the E is pronounced like the, a little bit like the AY in the word way. Okay, the word for a god is Deva, Deva. That's an E, Deva. And the O is pronounced like O. The word meaning he is so. Okay, now the pure nasal sound is the M written with a dot under it. This is pronounced something like the NG in sing. Ung, ung. So take the word for the round of birth and death, samsara, samsara. You hear that? Ung, ung. Okay, now we'll go to the consonants. We'll start with the velars and I'll go down. The K. 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 I'll give an example. Come. Come. Okay, now the voiceless aspirate, K, a little puff of air, K. You know the five aggregates? Kanda, Kanda. Okay, now the G, and the G is always pronounced like G, never like J. As in ginger, never like that. Okay, the voiced non-aspirate G, the Buddha's family name or clan name, Gotama, Gotama. And the GH the aspirate? The aspirate, the GH. It's hard to find this coming at the beginning, but let's take an example coming in the middle of a word. The name of the monk's outer robe is called the Sanghati. Sanghati. Or the name for the monastic order is the Sangha. Sangha. Not Sangha. But a little aspiration there. Sangha. And then the nasal, they represented in this book the same as the pure nasal, as an M with a dot under it. I have to say I do not like that. In most Pali texts, the velar nasal will be represented as an N with a dot over it. But there'll be no difference in the pronunciation. And this velar nasal will always be preceding a velar, another velar consonant. It never comes at the beginning of a word. So we could say, you know, the word for volitional formations or volitional activities? Sankara. Sankara. Where anything conditioned is sankata, sankata. That ung that comes before that is the velar nasal. Okay, now we go to the palatals. We begin with the voiceless palatal. The simplest, the most common, is the word for and, ch, ch. Also the word for mind is citta. Word for conduct, charana, charana. The voiceless aspirate, remember, a little puff of air, ch, ch. I have to look around to find one coming at the beginning of a word. It's not so common. Often this, okay, the word for six, ch. Ch. It's different from the word for and. The word for and is ch. The word for six is ch. 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 Okay, the J, the palatal voiced J, non-aspirate, j, j. The word for victory, jaya, jaya. Okay, the voiced aspirate, ja, ja. The word for meditative absorption is jhana, jhana. And then the nasal, palatal nasal, the N with that tilde or wiggle on top of it is pronounced like an NY, like the N in canyon, or like the N in onion, nya, nya. For example, we have the word for wisdom is panya, or the word for knowledge, jnana, jnana. But this palatal nasal also precedes, sometimes precedes, a palatal consonant like the ch or j, and then one doesn't try to pronounce it with that wiggle sound in it, but it comes out sounding just like an ordinary N. For example, a word meaning to travel around would be sancharana. Sancharana, traveling. Or a word meaning birth or production, sanjati. Sanjati. The retroflex, T. This is, the retroflex consonants are actually our normal way of pronouncing these consonants. It's the dentals that are somewhat difficult for us to pronounce. So the retroflex T, T, T. Let's take an example. The word, the verb for stand is titati. So there the T comes in the middle. Usually we get the two, the aspirate, the non-aspirate and the aspirate, coming one after another. I have to search for some example of okay, I'll take the aspirate coming at the beginning of a word. T. 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 The word for stable or steady. Tito. Tito. Okay, the voiced retroflex D. D. You get this in the middle of a word. The word meaning a learned person, pandita, pandita. Then the voiced aspirate, da, da. Usually we come across this as part of a double consonant, the non-aspirate first and the aspirate following it. For example, growth would be to grow, vadati. Vadati, vadati. First the non-aspirate, vad, followed by the aspirate, dati, vadati. With a noun meaning growth, vuddhi, vuddhi, vuddhi. Then the nasal is n, n. This will be the second N in the word, the N coming in the middle of the word, in the word for hindrance. Nivarana. The first N is the dental. Nivarana. Can you hear the difference? Nivarana. A word meaning virtuous quality, the N in the middle of this word, guna, guna. That's the retroflex N. The N in the word for death. Marana, marana, marana. Now the dentals. Okay, the voiceless, the T. 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 Okay, the word for him, tongue. Tongue. Okay, now the voiceless aspirate, it's not like the TH in the or that, just the slight aspirated form. The word for strength, tama, tama, tama. Okay, the voiced dental, the word for suffering, dukkha, dukkha, the word for sorrow, dominasa, dominasa, the voiced aspirate, da, da. An example, the Buddha's doctrine is the Dhamma, the Dhamma. Then the dental nasal. Okay, the first N here, the word meaning group or body. Nikaya, Nikaya. Well, the word meaning not, na, na. The tongue is pressed against the teeth when forming the word. N. There is not, the word that means there is not. Nati, nati. Okay, now the labials, starting with the voiceless, non-aspirate. P. P. The word that means to see, pusati, pusati. Okay, now the voiceless aspirate. This is not like f, not pronounced like the f, like phone, but it's just an aspirated p, p. The word that means fruit, pala, pala. To pervade, purity. Purity. Okay, the voiced labial, b, b, b. The word that means strength or power, bala, bala. Then the voiced aspirate, the bh, b, b. Burden is bara, bara. Fear is bhaya, bhaya. The Buddhist monk is a bhikkhu, bhikkhu. And then the nasal is ma, ma. Like path is magga, magga. Freedom is muti, muti. Okay, I think we've done enough for today. We'll continue with the alphabet, finish the alphabet next week.